Thank you for your prompt coming back on time. I appreciate that. We spent the first the time before we went for break talking about lessee and lessor. I think we had a good discussion about the views therein. So let us go to the slightly drill down a little bit more into the measurement side. I think we touched on a couple of times on the measurement in the first hour or so, but I think we will spend next 20 to 25 minutes talking about measurement. And Henry, why don't you just tee it up with what is that we are intending here to get feedback on?
Thanks, PK. Okay, so we're now moving to topic two, as PK said. I think the key thing I just wanted to highlight here is that the board's set out to significantly simplify the measurement model since the first exposure draft, given the extensive feedback that we received on the measurement proposals in there. In particular, just to highlight a couple of points, a reminder that the lease payments now included in the lease liability and the lease receivable only include the optional periods if the lessee has a significant economic incentive to exercise the option. And secondly is that lease payments exclude variable lease payments unless those lease payments depend on an index or a rate or are in substance fixed payments. So effectively most sales-based or usage-based lease payments are now excluded from the lease liability and the lease receivable. So with that, what we'd like to just sort of get your thoughts on in this section are the questions 5, 6, and 7. The questions are just focusing on the lease term, the treatment of variable lease payments, and also the discount rate. And perhaps in your responses, you could just sort of highlight any differences in your views between the initial measurement versus the subsequent measurement. So in particular, the question about whether the lease term or the variable lease payments should be reassessed and the like. So with that, let's see who would like to open the floor.
Wow. Yes. Doug.
I think I've actually repeated a few times, but I want to repeat again for the record. I think in the case of a lease arrangement which involves both land and building, in the case of JTC, perhaps actually in the case of Singapore and other land scarce country, to say that the primary asset should be the building will definitely pose a problem. Okay. I highlighted the fact that the media in Singapore reported not too long ago that the land costs actually constitute about 50 to 60% of the total cost of development. I think basically highlighted the fact that the land portion is significant. So in that regard, I would like to to propose to the board to reconsider under your para 33 whether it's appropriate to prescribe that in such a lease arrangement that the primary asset should be building. Or should it be left it to the preparer to basically make a judgment call to see which one is the primary asset?
So in terms of the para 33, your point is that right now para 33, if I understand or remember correctly, talks about if there is a land and a building, The building is considered to be the primary asset.
Right.
However, what I understand from you is that given the economics in certain jurisdictions, be it Singapore or Hong Kong or certain other high real estate price areas, you feel that the assertion that the building should always be the primary asset to be changed, you leave it to the judgment.
Yep.
Or do you propose not to separate it at all times? So what do you think about that? Instead of leaving it to preparer, which we can do, but that can bring inconsistency, that can bring compatibility issues, but if you are so worried about the way this is drafted, is there another cut to think about separating the two at all times?
I think separating them may be also a viable option to consider.
Okay. What about one thing? One thing I want to ask is that the board heard in spades in terms of variable payments, in terms of lease extensions from the first exposure draft to the second exposure draft. In response to that, whilst there could be some arguments both ways, the board felt overwhelmingly that we need to reduce the effort in this area and say all variable lease payments, unless they are indexed to an index, unless they are pegged to an index, should be excluded and should be recorded when it happens, unless it's an in substance. We're not talking about abusive situations. So any reactions to that? I just want to hear on that aspect also, especially we heard elsewhere about the difficulty in using the index every quarter to do that. So I just want to hear whether you all have any thoughts on that, or most of your leases do not have an index, so it's not an issue. That's one thing I want to spend some time on it. But
sorry, I'm not kind of speaking in response to your question. I'm just trying to add on to what Tak-Chen has mentioned earlier. I think we have some kind of a difficulty in trying to understand the fact that you're looking at property as a whole and you're looking at land having an indefinite useful life. And in the case of a lease of a building or a unit in a building, the presumption appears to be that, you kind of consume the building and then together with the land itself. But I think we have to bear in mind that land has indefinite useful life, and you're going to have numerous buildings that are constructed on a particular piece of land. And if you were to kind of assess the lease classification just based on the entire property and then thinking that, the consumption of the land, it's going to be very insignificant unless it's for a significantly long period of time, I think that concept is kind of a little bit problematic to us. I mean, we're struggling to understand how could you consume, if I'm leasing a space in the air, how could I actually consume the economic benefit of the land that would be kind of utilized together with future buildings that are going to be constructed on the land. We are struggling with that principle or that concept.
Yeah. I think the boards did it as a practical thing, but we hear the comments now. But yeah, the boards, I think to ease the measurement, I think that was the overriding reason in my mind. Also, I would like to hear about the variable lease payments. We heard through one of our outreaches while in the last 4 days, Henry and I were here, about certain properties in China where it's 100% variable lease payments. And so any thoughts, especially from our Chinese friends here, would be helpful. But I think I'll ask Chris to talk, then Tim, then Guang, if you want to.
So just starting off with lease term, we're generally supportive of the proposals that are there, with the exception of we don't agree with having significant economic incentive. We'd prefer that you'd stay with the existing criteria of reasonably certain, because we're not sure that there's enough benefit in actually making that change. And even though we've heard differing views as to whether or not the boards think that they're actually equivalent terms, if they're meant to be equivalent, don't change.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that. I think what we were just trying to say in terms of the equivalence, it's a similarly high threshold, because I think some people have thought we're trying to capture more options than today. But I think it is a slightly different assessment. And we did think it was it would be a more objective assessment. I mean, that was the theory behind it. It's to sort of try and say, there has to be something forcing the behaviour rather than just a strong intent to do something. So actually we felt that it was a more objective assessment. But a lot of people have made similar comments, Chris. But that was the thinking behind it. It's the same level of threshold, but it has something else there too.
And I think if you were starting from that was the only change, you could live with that. It's just that when you add it to the whole picture, it just starts to become, why do you need to change that one if it's basically working okay?
Well, and to be fair, sorry, I forgot. I think one of the other reasons for the changes is the fact that I think we're getting some understanding that the way the terminology is understood in IFRS and the way the equivalent terminology is understood in US is perhaps not entirely consistent in practice. So it seemed quite a good way to try and get greater consistency was to, you know, use this a new phrase.
The other concern we have around lease assessment is to try and ignore market factors. We just don't understand how you can do that in practice. So from that point of view. In terms of variable lease payments, our view would be we're sort of struggling with why you would want to have reassessments for variable lease payments around only indexes or rates. When you sort of look at the big picture, most of your really big changes often come around turnover rents, etc. So why single out the indexes or rates? Some of the modelling that we've done would suggest that you're not going to end up with very significant changes in any case, but it's obviously going to be a lot of work for people to go through that process. And on that basis, we'd sort of suggest having another think about that particular process. And that was really it.
Tim? Yeah.
I have a comment and a feedback. I would agree with the reassessment of the lease, but just a comment that the lessor, as a lessor, sometimes we do not know whether the lessee has significant economic incentive, and sometimes we do provide economic incentive, but they choose not to renew because they have decided to phase out the whole fleet.
What is that last sentence?
They decided to phase out the whole fleet.
Out the whole fleet.
So there's no... While there is an economic incentive, there is no operational efficiency or incentive to do so. As for the variable lease payment, it's very common for us to price lease rental pegged to LIBOR. So I do not see why there should be a reassessment of that, because any difference should go to income statement.
Yeah, we heard that comment elsewhere. Our friend Gojung, and then we'll talk to, we'll give it to Nicole and then to Yin.
Thank you, PK. Actually, as you mentioned, in my country, some constituents tell me that their lease payment are totally variable. So we don't know how to account for this kind of situation. Actually, I come here to look after the answer rather than give you a comment.
I would say wrong place.
when we refer to the lease term, I have a concern. Is that in the ED, maybe the paragraph 27, we permit the reassessment of lease term, but we prohibit the reclassification. So, because basically we have five classification in the new ED, maybe it's controversial. If we permit the reassessment of this term, but we prohibit the reclassification. When we refer to reclassification, I do have some concern about the classification. I think the major issues lessor accounting and lessee accounting are about the classification. So in my view, if we do want to change this current IAS 17, maybe a single model with narrow scope is a possible way to go. Because if we brought the property, the list of property in this scope, there are too much issues we cannot explain. especially the lessee accounting. The assets list under type B, we amortize the ROU asset in a way that a small portion at the beginning and a larger portion at the end. So maybe there is an impairment issue. Okay.
Thank you very much. Nicole?
Thanks, Peter. Just wanted to add our comments around lease term, that we generally support the model, that for the proposed measurement of the lease term, we agree that reassessment is necessary, but a concern that's been raised to us by a number of constituents is around the timing of that reassessment, as to whether that reassessment is going to be required every reporting period or whether it's required just on a trigger event. So we'd recommend some clarification around that, and our recommendation would be to follow something along the lines of 36 and having a trigger event. Similarly, for variable lease payments, we would agree with reassessment, but consistent with our previous comment letters, and we understand why you've done the change to the variable lease payments, but we don't support the change to variable lease payments. We think they conceptually meet the definition of assets and liabilities, so should be included in the right of use asset and liability.
I should immigrate to Australia, I guess.
Absolutely.
Ian. Yeah, thanks, PK. Yin Tong from Grant Thornton, Singapore. I would like to keep the reassessment simple.
Yeah.
In the sense that unless there's a modification to the lease, then there's no reassessment, which is consistent with what we are doing at the moment. I know we talk about optional renewal periods, optional renewal terms, and so on, but that would probably be a factor in determining whether a sale has occurred or not. On the variable lease payments, as Chris Peach has pointed out, the variable payments are a very broad group. I think it's difficult for a standard to envisage what sort of variety there would be, but if you're talking or focusing on inflation or interest rate indexes or indexes in general, then intuitively I would have thought that would be cost of financing rather than a change to the cost of the asset. So consistent with the reassessment of the lease term, unless there's a modification to the lease, then there's no reassessment as such.
Yuchi.
Thanks, Alan. We would like to comment on the in-substance fixed payments. We are not clear about what in-substance fixed payments are in the ED. We can see some examples in the ED, but there's
no... You mean in-substance variable payments?
In-substance fixed payments. Sorry.
Yeah.
There are some examples in the AD, but it is not defined or explained in the body of the AD, so we should each be clarified. For example, we are not clear whether the certain types of sales-based lease payment are included in the in-substance fixed payments, and also in the conceptual framework project about variable lease payment. In the conceptual framework project, the variable lease payments are discussed in section 2 or 3. So we are struggling with making comments on these projects. So the conclusion in the conceptual framework may affect this issue in the lease project. We should be consistent on this matter, I think.
So do you recommend then, what do you recommend in the interim if before the conceptual framework is finalized?
In terms of the lease project, we think that certain types of sales-based lease payment should be included. But when thinking about other types of examples in the conceptual frame project, we do not have any conclusion at this point.
So, if I heard you correctly, you think that certain sales base should be included in the lease payments?
Yes.
just a quick comment. We agree with the proposal, but in terms of reassessment, is it envisaged it's going to be a continuous reassessment, or if so, I think the proposal from a cost-benefit analysis would be an annual assessment instead?
Yeah, that I think that goes to the comment that Nicole made, is that I think the way, when I voted on this, I felt that this is an assessment which is on a quarterly basis or something like that. I think Nicole pointed out that they want a much more clarity on it and go for a trigger base rather than a continuous assessment kind of a thing. But I could be wrong, but the way I thought when I was voting on this is that it is more frequent than a trigger-based one.
Just building on the frequency of the remeasurement, I think our view is that we read it as at every reporting period, so it could be as frequent as quarterly. We recommend an annual kind of assessment with the thinking that for annual or quarterly revision, in most cases, will not be very significant to start off with. We also want to echo on the fact on in substance variable payments. I think our guys look at the examples that are in the exposure draft, example 17. The examples themselves kind of like they're quite fixed. We're not quite sure whether what is in substance fixed, because it sounds like it is fixed reading the example itself. So maybe a suggestion is to give more examples about what kind of in-substance fixed payments you are looking at.
See, is that the suggestion? The examples are just to clarify what we mean by in-substance. I think the board's intention at that time was that it is to prevent something disguised as non-fixed when in fact it is fixed. It is... I hate to use the word, and I don't know whether that's the right word, but I think it's to some extent an abuse prevention. But I think it's fascinating to hear so many people in so many parts of the world keep on saying that. That means that we got to do a better job of either explaining it, what we mean it, or remove it, or do something. Yeah. But I that's a constant comment that we hear. I don't think you're alone in it, so you can take comfort in that.
I mean, it's a difficult one. But I think what we wanted to do was just get the notion in there, principally so you guys would then be able to look at a very abusive arrangement and say, come on, that variability is not substantive. These are fixed payments. We do need to explain it a little better, as PK said, but I think we need to be very careful that we don't write too much on it, because then I think it will just be able to be abused. So I think we perhaps just need to... you know, clarify the notion a little bit better, but be wary, perhaps, of giving a lot of guidance on it.
I think we heard on the measurement, in my mind, pretty consistent themes from elsewhere in terms of... Tim, you want to talk anything more than on the measurement side, given the... you're affected that all your assets are going to be off the balance sheet now, and so all your aircraft is gone from the balance sheet. So I appreciate you talked already about the variable payments and that many of your variable payments are linked to LIBOR. But anything else from your dual role as a BOAC and also accounting standard setter and working group?
Yeah, I think I've said that because we majority of my leases are fixed to interest reference rate, LIBOR. So under current standard, I charge that to income. And we don't reassess the discount rate. The reason when we price a lease, we assume a long-term discount rate. And then any difference just goes to income statement.
Good. I think in terms of what we are looking for, the specific question that Henry teed up, I think what I heard is consistent from what we heard, and there's some people have said that they would like the variable payments to be part of it. I think to some extent ASBJ and to some extent, or to a large extent, WASB saying that. But otherwise, overall, there is a feeling that the simplification is in the right direction. There is no this question about the reassessment period that I think that's a common theme we heard. Indexing is another thing we heard here, which is again common theme we heard elsewhere. So that's good. So I think let us spend some time on scope, because I think there is especially I think we have a quite a good representation from the shipping industry. Three people here, and I know at least one of them sitting in the observer status, and we had a chat with them 2 days ago. So there is a lot of interest on it. So I think people have taken a lot of effort to come here, and I want to give them a good chance to talk about it. So why don't Henry tee up the scope, and then we will have Shinichi to talk first. But let Henry first talk about it, then Shinichi will talk first.
Thanks, PK. So turning to topic three, as PK said, this is just another area in the exposure draft which sort of is at where there was significant change since the previous exposure draft. The definition of the lease remains the same, but it's the supporting guidance for making that cut. Is it a lease plus a service contract, or is it just a service contract? It's that guidance which we significantly modified. In particular, it was the aspect of saying that for there to be a lease, the contract has to convey the right to control the use of the identified asset. And so what's new, I think, in the exposure draft is that control model that was developed to sort of give guidance about how to go about figuring out whether the customer, in other words, the lessee, has the right to control the use of the asset. And in particular, the guidance focuses on, you know, thinking about the ability to make the decisions about the use of the asset that most significantly affect the economic benefits to be derived from the use of the asset. So it's a difficult area in certain cases to make that line, and certainly some of the feedback that we've heard to date is sort of, it's perhaps supportive of the direction of travel, but it's sort of saying that perhaps the boards need to develop that framework a little bit more to help make what can be quite difficult judgments sometimes. The other area that people might want to comment on under topic three this morning is the question of separating leases and non-leases components. How the ED proposes that sort of lease and non-lease components get separated. So with that, let's open the floor to sort of questions 9 and 10.
Yeah, I think we should give Shinichi the first chance, then Shinichi next,
It's quite interesting that out of 22 participants, there are three participants from shipping industry. It's just because lease accounting is very important for shipping industry's accounting. And actually, we believe that time charter contract is not a is not a lease contract, but service contract. However, at the moment, we still have some concerns about exposure draft that time charter contract can be treated as a lease. So today I distributed our comment letter, JSS comment letter, for your reference. So if you if needed, please refer the our comment letter for details of our points. And we prepared some comments in answering to your question number 9 to 11. So can I make comments to each question?
Yes.
Thank you. And when I'm talking about shipping contracts, if I say charterer or shipping company, that means lessee. And if I say owner or owner of a ship, it means lessor. And first, about question 9, about additional guidance. And we basically agree with a concept about conveyance of right to use the asset in identifying a lease. We still think that two requirements defined in the paragraph 12 are not sufficient to judge if the right to control use of an identified asset is conveyed or not. We believe the board should add another criterion on the obligations and risks related to the asset. For example, in a time charter contract in the shipping industries, when an owner of the of a vessel provides transportation services to a charterer, he has a significant responsibility and obligation to maintain the vessel available for use during the contract period. And to maintain the asset available for use in shipping shipping industry means to arrange deployment of captain and crew, and repair and maintenance, and also insurance. So that is a responsibility of the owner. And in other words, the charterer can derive the benefit from the use of the vessel only if the owner performs his obligation to maintain the vessel available for use. Therefore, we think that responsibility and obligation to maintain the asset available for use should be considered to judge conveyance of the right to control the use of the asset before two requirements defined in the paragraph 12. And also please note that other than the responsibility to maintain the vessel available for use, the owner is responsible for safe vessel navigation to the charterer and also responsible for accidents at sea, which could result in huge losses like oil pollution or environmental disruption. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we recommend that the board add the criterion on the obligations and risks related to the asset. So this is our comment about question number 9. And regarding a question 10 about the separation of lease and non-lease components, we are concerned that our proposed lease ED seems inconsistent with the standard on revenue recognition. In the standard on revenue recognition, if a bundle of goods or services is distinct, the entity shall account for the bundle as a single performance obligation. For a time charter contract, we believe a single performance obligation is identified from perspective of the supplier or owner's view. However, according to the paragraph 19 in the proposed lease ED, we think the entity might identify a separate lease component and separate service component. Such accounting would be inconsistent with the treatment to identify a single performance obligation under the revenue recognition standard. Therefore, we would like to ask board to consider again the consistency with revenue recognition standard before you finalize the lease standard. And at last, regarding any other suggestions, we have one suggestion about ECD. certain contracts exist of which the price is determined by the supply and demand, and of which the components cannot be reasonably separated. We believe that such contracts do not include any finance components, and therefore they are not leases. However, we have significant concerns that the treatment for such contracts is not described in the ED. So we recommend that the board add an example of the transaction of which the price is determined by the market and of which the components cannot be reasonably separated. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shinichi. I think I read all the comment letters, but particularly the shipping industry comment letters to run up to this meeting. And I think your point about the single performance obligation and clarification to revenue is interesting, and I think it's a good point in my mind. But could you tell me, because when I read the three comment letters, and I cannot ask you alone, I think it's a question to all your colleagues, and also we had, like I mentioned, there is another company we met who is sitting as an observer today. I appreciate that some people say that it's not even a lease. And I heard some people say it is a lease, but we want it to be a type B lease. So I'm just curious to understand that why, and it could be you can come back and say this, that is because the way you wrote the exposure draft is creating the confusion, and that's a fair comment to make. But I want to understand why this is an issue specifically for time charter, and why wet leases in aircraft, wet lease, we haven't heard this comment to the same extent. And I just want to understand that aspect of it. So maybe this is not just to you, but to all you three colleagues here, all three of you, why there is a thing, confusion?
I think just because the term or period of time charter contracts varies, and some contracts are quite long as vessel's economic life, like 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. But those contracts are mostly for LNG tankers or crude oil tankers are actually controlled by oil measures. But we are talking about normal time charter contracts, which usual shipping companies are using. Is that answer to your question?
Yes and no. I'm focusing more on the scope aspect of it, and say that, you know, some people, I cannot remember who said what, but of the three comment letters, one, some said we don't believe it, and some in the industry believe it. And so what I'm trying to drive at it is that, could you tell us a little bit more about, I think you spoke about the fact that you don't get a space, you also get the captain of the ship and the employees of the ship, so it is, and you're saying it is inseparable and it's not possible to separate one from the other, so it's a single performance obligation, therefore it should be accounted as such rather than splitting into two components. That's the central theme I think I understand from your letter and your speech. But I'm just curious why it's, I appreciate the aspect that there needs to be a clarity, and I appreciate the aspect, and I have to tell you that after reading the comment letters, I could see your viewpoint a little better. But I was just curious why there is, maybe Shinichi can say, I think I remember the Asian Shipping Owners Association started from a different point than you did. No. What I'm saying is that I don't remember the comment letter immediately, but Asians, ship owners felt that it's not even a lease. So, and I think you're asking for an example, and these people say it's not even a lease because of this. Although the central point is the same between the three associations that are here, but I just want to understand a little bit more why within you, three of you, there is a difference to some extent. Whether in the scope or not in the scope.
Yuichi Sonoda, ASF. I don't think we are talking different point. As ASF, the Japanese Ship Owners Association is one of my members, and we fully support what he has just said. And I've got the impression from the ED that an exclusion of service contracts, such as time charters, appears to be accepted, but I'm not sure. And if so, in my view, the ED does not state it very clearly, and we need more explicit wording. That is what I can say at the moment. And our stance from shipping industry, I would say, identical. Thank you.
You want to say anything, Daniel, on this?
Okay. I think, basically, I think from the shipping industry point of view, I think basically our views are quite common in the sense that basically the contracts that are commonly used in the shipping industry do not convey the customer the right to control the use of the specified asset, which is basically the ship. I think as far as the operational aspect of the ship, it still rests with the ship owners. So a lot of the decisions actually made by the ship owners. We do not differ much from basically what Sonichi has said. I think we are basically in line in that sense. I would like to say that basically Yuchi and myself, we are not really operators in the shipping industry. Whereas Shinichi, basically, he works for the ship owners, so, ship owning company. So he fully understands, in that sense, you know, the operational aspect of the shipping industry. So I think his views are more operational in that sense.
So you are asking the difference between...
No. I understand that all three of you are on the same page, but your comment letters are talking in a slightly different style.
Yeah.
And so I was pushing on saying that could be partly because the way we have written it or the way you understand it. So I was just pushing on to understand a little bit more on that aspect. I don't think... I disagree. All three of you believe time charter should be out of scope. Mm. But some believe that it's already out of scope, and some people believe it should be explicitly explained that it's out of scope. So that's where I was pushing.
Yeah.
Anybody else, you want to say something?
I would frankly admit that in shipping industry, there are slightly different views. And some of the companies I know already disclose part of time charter arrangement. I know now what is the point for you from your questions. It's a judgment of the individual companies. And what we ask as a ship owners forum or shipping associations is to have a common principles to be applied to shipping industries accounting issue, and then based on that principle, it's I believe up to individual shipping lines how to disclose their assets.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sai Choi.
I'm not an insider to the shipping industry. I as I understand the debate, I have a concern which I wanted to express, which is I can see ourselves making a difference between time charter and bareboat charter, a service and an executory contract conclusion on one and a lease conclusion on another, and be quite happy that we have made a difference in our minds when, from what I understand of the shipping industry, they are considered to be very, very close equivalents in the business model. And for us in accounting to actually come up with quite different types of accounting for something that can be in fairly interchangeable in business model terms, but very different in accounting conclusions would be a huge problem for all of us. And I just want to point out we really should not end up with that distinction. And I think that is because the relative value of the lease, as it were, as opposed to the add-on crew cost, it is a proportion that really we should be focusing on, that the largest part is actually the bareboat part. Unfortunately, because of the volatility of shipping rates, the way we try to capture and look at the proportions, you could come up with different conclusions at different times, and that's where I think we could potentially be stuck with a problem in terms of how we write ourselves out of the situation that they have.
So just to understand one point, though, is there unanimity of agreement in the shipping industry? Whether bare-bone charters, are those leases or those are not leases?
We believe a bare-boat charter is a lease or just finance arrangement.
Okay. E&Y.
Sorry. Central of E&Y. I'm beginning to see the risk of diversity in practice because while we agree on the focus of control, as a conceptual, a consistent basis of seeing whether a lease exists, it's very judgmental as to who make the significant decisions surrounding a particular asset. So unless a proper framework is set out, you're going to see diversity in some of the arrangement that may flip to the side of a lease and while others view separately. So this is from a practitioner viewpoint, as a practicing auditor, you got to be a field day for the regulators to say that, I don't agree with you, it's professional judgment, but my judgment differs from yours. And we could have different fact pattern that marginally differs at the diversity.
Yep. I think we echo the view of the question now is the boundary of when an asset is passed on to the other party, how much control the lessor still have over this asset. Because in the example two, I think the coffee machine is a classic example. I mean, for coffee machine, because I think the argument is because you have to get a supply from the supplier, so that's why it doesn't turn out to a lease. But I think one could argue that, the coffee machine is sitting in the premise of the lessee, so why is it not a lease? So I think it's hard to understand the rationale. So I think the example itself doesn't give very clear guidance, then we're afraid that application could be worse, because then people may interpret differently and come to different conclusions. Yeah, I think that's the point.
Yeah. Been a lot of debate about coffee machines over the last 4 months.
Yes, sir. UET.
Maybe it's the duplication of what Shinichi has said. But for under the time charter contracts, owners of the vessel solely conduct ship management, and owners are looking after crewing, safe operation of ships, and on top of that, compulsory liabilities for oil pollutions and third-party injuries remain with the owners, not charterers. in that sense, while custom, I mean charterer, is given the right to decide which cargoes to carry and for whom and at what price, the control of vessel is still retained by the owner. In that sense, in our view, it is difficult to separate the service parts and the leasing parts, and also the price of time charter. I mean, time charter rates is decided by supply and demand of the charter market at that time. It means the price of time charter is fixed, almost no relation with the ship's price and the cost of ship management. And therefore, we believe that this is, in such contracts, we believe the components of the contracts are very difficult to divide.
But let me ask you a question, though. This is not unique to time charter. Suppose I have a high-rise building, and in the high-rise building, I have taken floor number 45. Okay? There needs to be a security. There needs to be elevator bank. The landscaping, everything needs to be done, because otherwise floor 45. It's very similar to time charter. The bare bone is the time charter, floor number 45. The services, the security, the elevators, and all that. So I'm just hard pressed to specifically mention, understand what is so separate from time charter to a situation like this in a building number, floor number 45, with the other services that are included that are essential to that. And I'm not against your view or anything. I'm just trying to understand if we want to say time charter should be excluded from the scope of the lease because the service is inextricably linked with the bare bone charter. I just wanted to. I'm just thinking if we were to make that exception tomorrow. My example, I would say I'm a real estate industry. I have exactly the same situation. How do I take care of that? So I'm just trying to understand. I heard one very smart comment from one of your industry person just the other day. He said, I said, how do you deal with this? He said, yeah, very simple. Make property, comma, vessels to be type B lease. So it's taken care of it. So then tomorrow somebody else will add something else. But no, I thought that was a very smart way of answering it. Not that I agree with the answer. But I just wanted to get what is so different, Yuichi. I know you are not real estate industry, but I see personally time charters as a floating real estate. Shinichi, you want to answer?
So now you mentioned the example of lease of the building, but I think. It's my opinion that it's not fair to compare with time charter contract with contract of the building or real estate, because you mentioned that for example to arrange security or landscape for the building, it's quite simple service, but in terms of time charter contract. Ship management is really complicating and very, very professional services provided by the owner. So I don't think it's not useful to compare those services for discussing lease.
So just to understand, I'm not trying to belittle you or anybody else. I'm just asking you if I have a whole, if I lease a floor number 45 in my example, it comes with other services, okay? So your stress is that it is time charter is so specialized, and that's the reason it should be separate.
So we are purchasing a kind of professional services from the owner.
Okay, so the stress is on the professional services, yes. Rather than the space.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, Reinhard, do you want to speak about it?
Yes, Ryan Klemmer is I need to come back to the principle discussion that I believe started with, should the liability be on the balance sheet? And if we talk about all the examples you just pointed out, then the commitment by entering into the contract encompasses both, maybe a lease element and something else. Nevertheless, the lease standard only focuses on the leasing part of it, not on the entire commitment. So when I have to go back to the kind of the starting point of it all, and you know, maybe if we need more information on the commitment part, the board's idea is to have it all on balance sheet, but would with the consequences of how to deal with the asset side and the revenue recognition as kind of like the fallout of the decision that it must be on the balance sheet. But if we talk about all those difficulties, would the user's information need not be served better by telling them what the commitment is and when the commitment comes due in, you know, kind of like a cash flow projection? And avoiding all the difficulties with accounting for the asset side and the revenue recognition by providing such type of information, and it would also avoid the distinction of, is the use of the elevator a service or is it part of the lease? At the moment, nobody really makes a distinction because the accounting would be the same. But if we make that distinction that lease accounting is significantly different from accounting for other services, from our perspective, we'll create another kind of bright line discussion as to the discussion, is it a service or is it a lease? And structuring will then happen around, can I separate my office lease into an office space lease and an elevator use contract and account for the two different? But from a user's perspective, wouldn't it be more useful to say, I have a commitment to pay this much for both the use of the elevator as well as the office space, and this is what my commitment is over the next 5 years. So from an ISCA's perspective, we would urge to go back and say, can you fix some of the on-balance, off-balance sheet problem by utilizing IAS 17 and the concepts that we have in place that are well proven, and provide the useful information on the liability side by improving cash flow disclosures.
Okay, good. Anybody else want to comment on it before we get on to other aspects, the item number four, Mui?
Yeah, steering away from shipping and other things. We do look at example five, which is very complicated kind of example on a power energy thing where, you know, the buyer of the power and the supplier of the power get involved in design, operating, and also part A is that there's a lease, part B of the example, and say that's not a lease. I think our comment on that is that if we base on the control model about whether you control the underlying asset, what's been written in here, perhaps it's not considered elaborating a bit more on what do you mean by control in such a situation. A comment in here is that perhaps we could look at IFRS 10 in the sense that those principles about what you are directing as the relevant activities could we apply in helping us to say that who actually then control that part of the facility or the asset itself.
Anybody else? Henry, why don't we go to item number four? And I think I teed it up by saying that I would like to hear a little bit on disclosures and a little bit of transition. But anything else you want to tee it up?
I think that was the main point about topic four, was just for people to raise any other comments on other particular aspects of the proposals. We imagined perhaps the focus here would be on the disclosure requirements, and also perhaps the transition approach, which of course is it's basically a retrospective approach, but does have various simplifications in there to try and sort of ease the transition approach. But the basic idea, it's a retrospective transition approach. So any comments on disclosure, transition, or any other particular aspects of the proposals that we've not covered in the discussion so far.
Just a couple of quick comments. We're concerned about the level of disclosure because obviously the complexities of the model suggest that nobody's terribly sure about the underlying principles, and therefore there seems to be a bit of let's put in as much as we possibly can to compensate for that. So I think that's the challenge that you have to face, that it would be nice to have the model right and then perhaps you can have less disclosures. But certainly we'd be suggesting that you need to have a really good look at those disclosures, and there seems to be a lot of inconsistencies again with some other standards, so we'd strongly encourage you to pare back what you have in terms of the disclosures. In terms of the transition requirements, we'd just say please again be consistent. There's some new things with revenue and with IFRS 10 which we'd suggest should also be relevant for these leasing proposals as well.
So when you talk about transition, be consistent, are you suggesting that the transition should be a cumulative catch-up option should be given or something like that? Yeah, okay. Okay. Nicole?
Just in terms of disclosure, echoing Chris's comments, we do think it is excessive disclosure. We did question overall why the leasing standard would need its own disclosures. If we look at a higher level, if we're looking at a right-of-use asset, either as intangible or intangible, we've already got disclosures in IS 38 and IS 16. So we would recommend looking to those already existing disclosures rather than creating a whole new set of disclosures for the lease transactions. And the only other comment I wanted to make in terms of other issues was around short-term lease exemption. And we did question the need for the short-term lease exemption in the standard. And we think that actually creates more complexity rather than reducing complexity or reducing the cost associated with applying the proposals. We think there's already a sufficient principle in IFRS, which is the principle of materiality. And if a lease is immaterial, then it won't be addressed by the proposals. If it's material, it should be accounted for. We'd be very concerned if there were material leases that weren't accounted for by applying the model. Thanks.
Anybody else? Yes, from Grant Thornton.
Yitong Grant Thornton. Perhaps when you consider disclosure, if the board can take into account the extent to which leasing is an activity of the entity or the business. So, for example, you could have tiered disclosure requirements, maybe more disclosure requirements for an entity that is a lessor and there's financing as a main activity or the only activity. And perhaps, you know, for lessees that have got low value incidental type of leases like photocopiers or even motor vehicles, the disclosure requirements could be a lot less.
Okay, good.
I'd like to comment on the transitional approach, actually. I'd like to comment on the transition approach and its impact on JTC. I think the current retrospective and modified retrospective approach as envisaged by the ED will have a significant impact actually on a corporation like ours because my corporation essentially is in leasing and we are about 45 years old and we have 10,000 leases. So you can imagine the challenge actually to go back actually, you know, I think over the 10,000 leases and to decide is it type A, type B, or that? I think it would be really a big, big challenge for us. So I just want to register my comment on that.
10,000 leases. Nicole, you want to comment on it, or you have your placard up? Okay, Sharik.
Yeah. I've got a slightly different comment, and I haven't personally thought it through properly, and that's in regard to from a lessee perspective when you've got a type B. So because it's a straight line expense and the amortization is smaller to begin with and higher later on. So my concern is, especially if you're in a type B situation and it's pretty long term, 15, 20, whatever number of years, potentially you could have an impairment trigger. And, you know, if this was a type A lease and where you are straight lining to amortization, the answer could be different from an impairment perspective compared to a type B lease. So I haven't thought through from a CGU perspective and an impairment assessment IS 36 whether the corresponding fact you've got a liability, whether you take that into account. But just focusing on the asset, I just feel concerned that there could be an unintended consequence because we are putting in the amortization at a lower amount up front, you could have an impairment because if it's 1 or 2 year lease, I don't think it's going to make a difference. But if you have a property lease for a lessee, which is pretty long tail, you could have an issue. And I'm just concerned whether there's enough guidance to be provided or what are the different considerations and to the link up with IS 36 from that perspective.
Yeah, just so you know, the boards have talked quite extensively on that aspect when they were thinking about these two, and I think there is a potential for more. Yeah, that's there. Suad.
Thank you, PK. Just wanted to comment on the sale and leaseback. I think the requirement and the proposal is that you use the major part of remaining economic life or substantially or fair value to conclude whether the transferor lessee actually obtains substantially all the remaining benefits of the asset. And we are kind of agreeable with that, except that we kind of observe that it runs counter to using the same kind of criteria to determine whether the lessee is expected to consume more than an insignificant portion of the economic benefits of the underlying asset. And potentially you could result in an outcome that is inconsistent because you could actually kind of, there is actually a sale, but because of the fact that you are putting that kind of criteria and if, so just give you an example, if a transferor actually transfer a piece of land with a freehold land to the lessee to the transferee, and the transferee actually lease back the transferor lease back the property. Essentially, there's a building on the piece of land, and the remaining economic life of the building say it's 10 years. And the transferor leases back the property for 10 years, and it's really for the building. But if you apply the principle or the requirements in the proposal for sale and lease back, you're going to end up saying that it's not a sale. And we think that that's not, the outcome is not correct.
Yeah.
Because the fundamental, the primary or the predominant asset in that sale transaction is really the land. The transferor is trying to unlock the value in the freehold land. And the leasing back of the building for the remaining economic life, it's really a lease. So they are actually a sale and it's a lease back, rather than, you know, concluding that it's not a sale, it's actually a lease itself. So that's something that perhaps the board should look into. The other point that we have is on the ROU assets that meet the definition of inventories. So, for example, if a property developer actually obtain a leasehold land and kind of construct a building on it for sale, it is currently unclear whether the ROU asset should be measured at amortized cost, or rather should be measured at cost less accumulated amortization, or should it follow the requirement in IS2 inventories? I think it is currently unclear. The other point that we have is on the ROU assets that meet the definition of investment property.
Mm-hmm.
We do not agree with the proposal that it should be measured at fair value if the lessee actually measure investment property under the fair value model. We think that ROU asset and investment property, they are fundamentally different. And it is also consistent with the fact that for ROU assets that meet the definition of a PPE, you are given an option whether to revalue or to carry it at cost even though you could have measured the underlying PPE using the fair value model, the same class of PPE using the fair value model.
So you're just saying that effectively should be allowed to have a category of investment property at fair value and then right of use investment property, like just because I've done fair value on the one, the other could be cost and not fair value.
That's right, yep. That's right. There should be an option, either fair value or cost.
Yeah. Last comment from, you still want to say something?
So yeah, just to add what Sok-Cheng has said. Yeah. I think if you look at sale and lease back, a type A lease of a real estate will never qualify for sale and lease back. And I think the problems which Sok-Cheng pointed out is because of the fact that, you know, the unit of account in a sale and lease back is the asset, whereas it's quite inconsistent with the right of use.
Yep, I agree with that. Yeah.
I just want to add one comment, which is kind of Singapore specific, or there could be some other jurisdictions. There could be some other jurisdictions who could have that, and this is in the context of 99 and 999 year type of leases. So, you know, whilst the underlying presumption is that land has got indefinite life, but because of the way the present value works, you could have a situation that from a lessee's perspective, even some of these, maybe not the 999, but even the 99 year leases could become type A leases. And therefore, whilst we've all talked about having a single approach, but if we continue with the dual approach, there could be a inconsistency in just terms of in terms. So I think some kind of guidance as to where, because it just doesn't fit in with the consumption model.
Sure, that's fair. I think let us spend last. Thank you very much for those comments, and those are useful, especially with the other aspects. Let us spend 5 minutes, if you have any burning closing comments, which you have not already spoken, in terms of the model. I think we got a clear understanding from your oral comments where the trend is and what is the viewpoint here is the... But any other burning comments that you have that you absolutely need to say? Yes, sir. Thomas.
This is a very broad base beyond leases, but my impression at watching all of this that's gone on in the accounting industry over the last 20 years is we're getting to a point where we're somewhat undermining our own credibility, because we're not having improvements, so to speak. We're having large shifts in how we account for things. This is a major shift. Similarly, with financial instruments, we're facing the same thing. Revenue recognition, it's more a bit of the philosophy, you know, balance sheet versus income statement. But over time, these kind of shifts, people have to question, were they getting it wrong before and now they're getting it right, or are they just getting it wrong again? Especially with, like, the expected loss, incurred loss model thing, where we're moving back to the problem, but that now is the solution to the problem that was the solution. So I think we have to be mindful of that as well, the credibility issue that this creates. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. I can I request to stick to your comments just to the leases?
Yes. Yes. Faithful representation need not be complex. I think this ED is quite complex. It is, I think, as Tak Chuan put it earlier, it is quite a rule-based standard. And not only that, you've got a rule-based standard that has got very significant judgmental input. And that's a real powder keg of things. I mean, personally, you know, I've got no problems flying on airlines with no planes on the balance sheet.
You don't have problems. Poor David Feedy. Anybody else? Yes, Chris.
I will restrict this to the leases, but I think I really do echo Thomas's point. I think credibility is incredibly important. And when you're putting out leasing proposals, that the best titles you can come up with are type A and type B, and that some of the descriptors are actually numerical answers, that's just not helpful.
Yeah, but the basic blood group is type A, type B, type C. You know, the basic blood group is type A, type B, so what's so wrong about it? So, anyway,
but we do support the proposals. We need to have improvements.
We take your point. I'm just trying to make fun of it. Anybody else? Henry, you want to have any?
Maybe just a to give an indication of kind of what happens next. Obviously, this is an exposure draft that's attracted a great deal of attention. Staff members and board members from both ISB and FASB have been very busy, you know, and I gave some insights into to what we've been doing. Clearly, we've heard a lot in the roundtables that we've held, and as I think I mentioned earlier, we've got now over 600 comment letters. So we've got a lot of analysis to do of all of the feedback that we've received. I think what we envisage at the moment is that we will be able to give the boards an overview of the comment letters, the roundtable feedback, and all of the other feedback at the November board meeting. So that's when we would envisage sort of starting and kicking off, if you like, the redeliberation process. And hopefully what we will be doing at that stage also is sort of laying out what are the sort of key areas that the board will need to sort of go back over in their redeliberation. So giving a shape of how we expect the project to run forward to hopefully a successful completion. So that's essentially what should happen next.
Yep. I think my advice to you all. Nagraj, you want to say something? Yeah. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I mean, it's been fairly very good discussion or comments raised. And generally, from the accounting, Singapore Accounting Standards Council's point of view, we support the effort to improve lease accounting and the fact that liabilities get on the balance sheet. We see that there are more than one type of lease, so there's, you know, the dual lease accounting. But the important thing we would like to do is, like many have said, is to reduce the cost or complexity of this whole thing, simplify many issues in here. If you had a single sort of classification principle, that would make it easier for people to think it through. And if certain liabilities don't come on balance sheet, and we did say we support operating lease accounting for, you know, the type B, we think we can live with that, but we will get most of it on balance sheet. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you. I think my recommendation would be to stay tuned. I think there will be the boards have diligently taken a lot of feedback, and I'd have to tell you that the staff has done an amazing job of trying to reach out every nook and corner of the world to get the issues at least to be surfaced. I think personally, I think this will be an interesting project to observe how it is going and where it is going. Unfortunately, I would say that unlike revenue project, this has got some political connotations to it, and there are a lot of politicians who are getting involved with it. So I think it will be a good effort on the boards to start, first of all, to take stock of where we are to decide, and like Henry just mentioned. But on a personal note, I really want to thank each and every one of you for making time to come. I am very heartened by the fact that people have come from Japan, Australia, China, so thank you very much for your participation. And amazingly, we are on time. And thank you very much.
PK, just we'd like to thank the ISB for coming out to this part of the world. We see more of you these days, and we welcome that. And these outreaches are quite useful. And thank you for holding the roundtable in Singapore. It was very useful. Thank you.